It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Bombings claimed by the Islamic State militants in the Syrian cities of Damascus and Homs killed at least 140 people on Sunday. The blast came as Secretary of State John Kerry said a provisional agreement has been reached with Russia on an end to hostilities that could begin in the next few days. Trinity University Middle East scholar David Lesh says this is encouraging news, but a ceasefire will not be easy to implement. He said the problem with any sort of cessation of hostilities is that there are so many players involved in creating the cessation of violence that it creates many opportunities for spoilers. That's something Syrian President Bashar al-Assad agrees with. He says his government is ready to take part in a ceasefire as long as it is not used by militants to reinforce their positions. Counting is underway from Sunday's presidential and legislative elections in Niger. The results are not expected until sometime next week. Mahamadou Issoufou is running for a second 5-year term with a promise to crush Islamist militants. About 14 other candidates were running against Issoufou, including Senye Omarou, the leader of an opposition coalition. President Issoufou told the French news agency he is absolutely sure he will win the election and predicted a runoff will not be needed. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has commended the Central African Republic for successfully holding peaceful elections. Mr. Ban congratulated former Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadera on his victory. This is VOA News. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni is in power since 1986. On Sunday, denounced criticism from the opposition of vote rigging from the European Union and United States over the harassment of opposition figures following his victory in Thursday's election. Key opposition leader Kisi Besigye, who failed for a fourth time to unseat Mr. Museveni, explained their opposition to the election. He said the reason they rejected the election outcome is not because of their inherent unfairness and injustice. He said the reason he rejected the outcome was because of what happened. He said the targeting and disenfranchising of hundreds of thousands of their supporters. The European Union denounced the process as having an intimidating atmosphere with an electoral commission lacking independence and transparency. A U.S. spokesman said the Ugandan people deserve better, and former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo, head of the Commonwealth Observer Mission, said the ballot fell short of meeting key democratic benchmarks. London Mayor Boris Johnson spoke with British Prime Minister, David Cameron, on Sunday, declaring he is joining the campaign calling for Britain's exit from the European Union. Cameron's push to remain in the EU comes after the unrest of the EU agreement on a package of concessions to Britain, which means London does not have to comply to as many requirements as other EU member states. At least 17 people have been killed in a powerful tropical cyclone that struck Fiji on Saturday. The government has imposed a nationwide curfew and declared a month-long state of natural disaster. Scores of residents have sought shelter and evacuation centers set up across the islands. Hillary Clinton is atop the U.S. Democratic presidential race after narrowly defeating Senator Bernie Sanders in the Nevada caucus over the weekend. On the Republican side, businessman Donald Trump is in the front-runner postings, winning in New Hampshire recently and in Saturday's South Carolina primary. Florida Senator Marco Rubio edged out Texas Senator Ted Cruz for second place behind Trump. Also on Saturday, South Carolina Democrats will have their primary election, while Republicans in Nevada will caucus the same day. And it was a first-ever win at NASCAR's Daytona 500 for Japanese automaker Toyota. American Denny Hamlin was the driver, Martin Truex Jr. coming in second, also in a Toyota, and Kyle Busch finished third, giving Toyota an unprecedented sweep of the podium.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, February 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. One of the presidential candidates in Thursday Uganda election says his house had been under siege days after the election.
The military police and regular police surrounded my house 2 days ago. They have been arresting people coming to my home. My coup has been disappeared for 2 days. And he told us he had been arrested as he was trying to enter the house.
That's former Prime Minister and presidential candidate Amama Mbabazi. Counting has begun in Sunday's Niger presidential and legislative elections. The UN Secretary General commends the people of the Central African Republic for holding peaceful presidential elections. And South Sudan says it welcomes UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's visit to Juba this week.
We will inform the Secretary General on the efforts being exerted by the government of the Republic of South Sudan in the implementation of the agreement up to this moment.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. U.S. troops provide educational tools to Cameroonian schools, and a simple blood test diagnoses people with active tuberculosis. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Ugandan Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and presidential candidate for the Go Forward team says his residence was under siege by Ugandan military police and regular police in a few days following last Thursday's election. He said police arrested people coming to his house, including his cook, who he said disappeared for 2 days. Mr. Mbabazi says although the government has yet to inform him directly, but he said the prime minister has told the local media that he, Mbabazi's movement, has been restricted. He condemned the government's use of the state machinery to deprive candidates in the election of their freedom of movement. Mr. Mbabazi said the election was fundamentally flawed and the announced results not a reflection of the will of the Ugandan people. He said his team will determine its next course of action once it has completed gathering more information about what exactly happened on election day.
I did publish a statement to the effect that all along from the time I entered the campaign, the ground has not been leveled because, of course, as you know, the state used all possible state organs to harass me personally. They arrested me, they arrested my daughter, to intimidate my supporters. They denied me the opportunity to use the airwaves belonging to the state, public radio and television. So the level was obviously not the same. That was in the beginning of the campaign. As we went along, we've had a one-sided, therefore, partisan electoral commission. They were clearly working in favor of the incumbent. And the declaration of results was in many ways fraudulent because up to now, we don't have particulars of the results at polling station. So we are getting evidence which will inform our next course of action.
So what's the next course of action? Are you thinking about legal course of action?
Of course, one is to go to court and challenge the declaration of results, the electoral commission. Yes, that one is possible because there are certain electoral offences under our law that would negate an election if they are proved to have occurred or have been committed by the one who benefited from those offences and won an election. But the other courses, we can use political action and so on and so forth.
We are reading that Dr. Besigye is under house arrest. Are you under house arrest? And what do you make of that if Dr. Besigye is under house arrest?
The military police and regular police surrounded my house 2 days ago. They have been arresting people coming to my home. My coup having disappeared for 2 days. And he told us he had been arrested as he was trying to enter the house. And he had no idea where he was before he was off. And he couldn't trace him. But you are taken by police interrogating him about what has been happening here. According to the Prime Minister, my movements have been restricted. I have not been informed officially about it. But this is a statement he made to the media. Now, Dr. Ritz, of course, is under much closer surveillance and watch. And I have condemned this. I said it's not right for one of the contestants to civilians the right to move around and interact with their supporters.
Honorable Mbabazi, there are some people who are suggesting that perhaps had you and Dr. Besigye and the other top opposition people come together with a single candidate, do you think that would have made a difference in the results of the election?
I'm sure it would have, but unfortunately, we say, we can't undo that. The government would have been much different, yes.
Honorable Mbabazi, thank you very much again. So nice to talk with you.
Okay, thank you. It was nice talking to you again.
That was former Ugandan Prime Minister and presidential candidate Amama Mbabazi. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Vote counting has begun in Niger's presidential and legislative elections after the polls closed on Sunday. The results are not expected until sometime next week. Mahamadou Issoufou is running for his second five-year term with a promise to crush Islamist militants and develop Niger, one of the poorest countries in the world. About 14 other candidates were running against Issoufou for the presidency. Critics of Issoufou say he used political repression in the run-up to the vote, arresting opposition supporters, politicians, journalists, and even a singer who released a song critical of him. President Issoufou told the French news agency he's absolutely sure he will win the election and predicted a runoff will not be needed. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has commended the Central African Republic for successfully holding peaceful presidential elections. Mr. Ban congratulated former Prime Minister Faustin Touadéra on his victory and called on the leaders of the war-torn country to maintain a constructive atmosphere. Touadéra, a former math professor, was declared the winner on Saturday after sweeping to victory with more than 60% of the vote in last week's runoff. The results of the first round of the parliamentary poll will not be announced on Saturday, but are expected soon. The UN chief also called for the timely holding of the second round of legislative elections to complete the political transition process. The new president has pledged to rebuild the state, working closely with the international community. The South Sudan government says it welcomes UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's visit to Juba later this week. Mr. Ban is due in the South Sudan capital on Thursday, his second visit since the country got its independence in 2011. It comes at a time that implementation of the peace agreement signed last August between President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar has been very slow. Mr. Machar has said he will only travel to Juba to form a national unity government when nearly 3,000 of his troops and police are in the capital, with a further 1,200 police deployed to Bor, Malakal, and Bentiu. South Sudan Information Minister Michael McQuay says his government will inform the Secretary General about the efforts it is making to implement the agreement.
The government of the Republic of South Sudan highly welcomes the visit of the Secretary General because this is where he will get real facts on the ground. It is very clear now he is expressing his disappointment, but it seems that it is not clear to him who is responsible for the delay in the implementation of the agreement. It's so that he is coming to the ground to come and know exactly who is responsible for the delay. And instead of just being get disappointed because the parties are not implementing, he should get disappointed because X or Y is not implementing or is obstructing the implementation. So we highly welcome him, and I hope that his disappointment will be clear.
Who is delaying the implementation? It's your government, because I think Dr. Riek Machar has said he's willing to come to Juba, but he wants his security people to come to Juba.
Well, we have already told them that we don't have the means of transporting his people to Juba. Not that only, but the IGAD, the Troika, and the EU have promised they have undertaken to transport his people here. But it is not enough for him to see that his forces should be transported to Juba because he has another condition, that he must make sure that the necessary conducive atmosphere is in Juba. And he is one who will determine that conducive atmosphere. So definitely he's the one to tell us when will that atmosphere be conducive for him to come. But for us in South Sudan, I think the atmosphere is already conducive and there is nothing that can prevent him from coming.
So, Minister, I know I did speak with you about Malachi. Did your government send soldiers to Malachi?
We have no competence to interfere with whatever happened inside UNMISS camp. And you could not believe me because you don't believe that in South Sudan, the UNMISS camps are enclaves that are under UNMISS only and UNMISS only. The government of South Sudan has no right to intervene or enter this camp.
Mr. Minister, so is your government going to assure the Secretary General that there will be movement, particularly the formation of the transitional government?
We will inform the Secretary General on the efforts being exerted by the government of the Republic of South Sudan in the implementation of the agreement up to this moment. That is one. Now, two, we will inform him about the role of the UNMISS forces and what they are doing.
Mr. Minister, you are kind. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Today's Monday, February 22nd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and still to come, Marco Uma, sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. U.S. troops deployed to Cameroon to help fight the Boko Haram insurgency have donated school benches and educational material to Cameroonian schools. Cameroonians have been expressing satisfaction, saying that troops have shown interest in their immediate well-being. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Hundreds of teachers and school children have gathered at the government primary school near the 301 Cameroon Military Air Force base in the northern town of Garoua to receive school benches, chalk, exercise books, pens and pencils from U.S. troops assisting Cameroon in its fight against Boko Haram insurgents. Among the curious observers is Nana Mamudu, whose three children attend the school. He says he now believes the American troops are interested in their well-being.
We do not know what the Americans were doing here. They were only staying in their military camp. But now that they have decided to help us with school benches, we know they have our interests at heart.
Cameroon Air Force Colonel Evina Bartholomé Marie says after they helped the community to build the school, American troops detached to Garoua agreed to provide some furniture and help community leaders encourage children to go to school.
We are struggling with parents to fix the school. We have already done it. Problem we had, it was a problem of desk. And as American people provide us some desk, we are very grateful.
Last year, Cameroon announced it had closed at least 200 schools on its northern border with Nigeria that have suffered frequent Boko Haram attacks. Many students have sought education in safer localities in the Central African nation's hinterlands, thereby exerting pressure on infrastructure and adding to some already congested schools. A United Nations report published last December said the Boko Haram insurgency in Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, Niger, and other countries has led to the destruction of schools and infrastructure and contributed to about 1 million children being deprived of education. Roberto Quiroz, public relations officer at the United States Embassy in Cameroon, says U.S. troops came to help because of U.S. interest in the well-being of all children and in recognition of Cameroon's efforts to eradicate the terrorist group.
President Obama talks about the future of Africa. He remembers that every child has great value and every child deserves a great opportunity for the future. We have seen that Cameroon has taken a very brave stand with courage to fight Boko Haram. And the United States is here to support that leadership, support that vision, to support those efforts that are made by Cameroonians.
U.S. troops have been helping Cameroon fight Boko Haram by providing intelligence, war equipment, and training its soldiers. In March 2015, Cameroon launched an $8 million emergency plan to construct schools in safer localities away from volatile areas overrun by Boko Haram. The government said it still needed more support to cope with increasing school demands. There are concerns that lack of education may fuel radicalism, especially now that Boko Haram is recruiting child suicide bombers. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
An experimental blood test could diagnose people who have tuberculosis, separating those with active TB from those with the latent form. The test is easier than current methods for detecting the lung disease and has the potential to find and treat many more people, VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Each year, 9.6 million people become infected with tuberculosis. 1.5 million of them die. The rest will silently carry the bacterium in a latent state, with the constant threat that it could become active TB. It's estimated that one-third of the world's population is infected with TB, and the active cases are difficult to diagnose. Purvesh Khatri, a computational immunologist who analyzes data on TB infections, says there are limitations to the current diagnostic test, which uses sputum, which is coughed up from a person's respiratory tract. While it's highly accurate looking for the presence of the TB bacterium in mucus, it's hard to perform on some people.
The problem is that it requires sputum, and the children cannot cough up sputum.
In addition, the traditional test can't distinguish patients with active TB from those who have recovered from tuberculosis and people who've received the BCG tuberculosis vaccine. Also, it can be hard to detect TB in those infected with the virus that causes AIDS. So in 2014, the World Health Organization challenged researchers to develop a simple blood test to easily diagnose and sort out those who have latent disease from those who have active TB. Khatri and his colleagues at Stanford University in California have done just that, creating a highly accurate blood test that could be performed in resource-poor countries where new infections are common. When someone becomes infected with active TB, it sets off a chain reaction of activity in hundreds of genes. The blood test developed by Khatri and colleagues identifies three genes that respond in a consistent pattern when the disease becomes active. In a study published in the journal The Lancet Respiratory Medicine, the Stanford scientists report the results of the test in 1,400 blood samples. It correctly diagnosed 86% of the samples from children with active TB, and the test was accurate in 99% of cases where there was no active disease. Khatri says the blood test may also be used in another way.
We may be able to use this same signature as whether the patient is responding to treatment or not.
Researchers next plan to conduct a clinical trial in Brazil to see how well the blood test works in the real world with people who have been exposed to tuberculosis. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsoring here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Enjoying home advantage, the Democratic Republic of Congo's Orange Africa Champions League title holders TP Mazembe pipped Tunisia's Orange Africa Confederations Cup title holders Etoile du Sahel 2-1 to win their third Orange African Super Cup in Lubumbashi on Saturday. Turning to athletics, South African Hosi Tsotsane clocked 30 minutes and 22.7 seconds to win the 10 kilometers at the best made road race in the South African capital Tshwane on Saturday. His sights are now set on the Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
And the way I felt about the race today, it was fine, because now I'm looking to run at least around here in Pretoria. This Molanyana race is to build up my fitness now. Because last year I did struggle maybe two years back now with minor injuries, but now I'm glad that I can join the guys with the racing pace and everything. So.
You won this race in 2013. Last year you were second. You've come back and won again. So it says well about your fitness. What do you want to achieve this year?
Now I'm looking upon 5,000 in the track, 5,000 meters in the track, so that maybe I can form part of the Olympic team. But now I can see the way my training is going. I'm not far. I'm still there with the the guys, maybe I can dip under my personal best of 13:30.
That was Hosi Totane, winner of the 10 kilometers at the Best Med Tax Road Race, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. Meanwhile, returning from a maternity break, South African Yvette Fancel won the women's 10 kilometers in 33 minutes and 55.3 seconds. She aims at breaking new grounds in the marathon.
It's nice to be back racing again. I try not to race a lot because the training is quite important now for preparing for London Marathon. But today was nice, a bit hot and humid out there. It was a nice race overall, and I think I can't complain. Another sub 34, so I think preparation is going well.
You've got your London Marathon, as you say. It's going to be your first big marathon. What are your projections? What time are you looking at?
Well, I've been away from the marathon quite a bit now for a few years, so I think we're going to see what the other ladies have run, because the focus is just to qualify for Rio. To make the team, you have to run a sub 2:30. So I think it's going to be a tough qualifier for the marathon.
What is your personal best in marathon?
A 2:31.
That was Yvette Fancel, winner of the women's 10 kilometers at the Best Made Road Race in Tshwane, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up,
stand up. It's time now for Black History Month and African History Facts and Trivia question for today, February 22nd. On this day in 1950, basketball star Julius Winfield Irving was born in Hempstead, New York. His acrobatic moves on the court won him the nickname Dr. J. His career as an NBA player began in 1976 with the Philadelphia 76ers and lasted until 1987. During that time, Dr. J led the 76ers to the NBA Finals four times and won the championship in 1983. He was an All-NBA first-team selection five times and averaged about 22 points per game. On this day in 1989, singer Tina Turner won a Grammy for Best Female Rock Vocalist at age 49. Tina Turner became one of the oldest female artists in history to stage such a strong comeback. She was introduced in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. Did you know that Douglas L. Wilder was the first black to be elected governor in the United States since Reconstruction? In 1989, Wilder was elected governor of the state of Virginia. Prior to Wilder, only one other black person had served as governor. He is P.B.S. Pinchback, who briefly served as governor of Louisiana in 1872 after the sitting governor there was impeached. On this day in African history in 1966, Ugandan Prime Minister Apollo Milton Obote ordered the arrest of five of his cabinet ministers and assumed the presidency. Obote had been implicated with his army commander, General Idi Amin, in a scandal involving a collection of gold and ivory taken from neighboring Congo. And on this day in African history in 1964, Ghana's founding president Kwame Nkrumah declared a one-party state, the Convention People's Party, with himself as life president. Some say it was one of Nkrumah's biggest mistakes because 2 years later, Nkrumah would be overthrown in a military coup d'etat. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 22nd. Congratulations to Edward Musonda of Mbala in Zambia, Professor Rems Umiasibu of Oka in Anambra State, Nigeria, and Okitayo Santo of Juba, South Sudan. You are the winners of our February 19th question, who is the first African-American student to enroll at the all-white University of Mississippi in 1962? The answer, James Meredith. Now here is our question for today, February 22nd. Who were the Tuskegee Airmen? Once again, who were the Tuskegee Airmen? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. That's it for this Monday, February 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty, I am James Barton in Washington, hoping that your week will be a productive one.
Next on Let's Talk. Bullying. Are you intimidated by it? Why does it happen? What is your experience? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing bullying. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com. News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.